This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. So this evening, we're coming to you live from Maggie's Tavern, St. Johnston, County Donegal, and we're here to mark the 421st year of the passing of Red Hugh O'Donnell, the Fighting Prince of Donegal. Yes, I'm old enough to remember the Disney movie of 1966. Now, no discussion of Red Hugh would be complete, however, without consideration of the real mover and shaker in these events, the power behind the throne, his mother, Eineen Dhu. So to discuss these and related questions, I'm joined by Billy Kelly on the far right there, who's a research project coordinator at the Institute of Ulster Scots Studies at the University of Ulster McGee campus. And immediately to my right, it's a bit early for the applause yet, as early yet as Mark Groucho Marx would say. On my right here, Eamon O'Keara, lecturer, I was going to say lecturer in history, but Eamon lectures in everything, basically, in the University of Ulster McGee campus. On my left, Matthew McGinty, whose PhD is from the University of Galway, and it's on Gaelic succession, overlords, Iriha, and the 9 Years' War. And finally, the man who's organised the whole thing, Tomás O'Brogan, historian, living history practitioner, not a reenactor, he always stresses to me, also cartographer extraordinaire. And any of you who are readers of History Ireland will know the excellence of Tomás's work in the magazine over the last number of years. Now, this Hedge School is supported by the Red Hugh O'Donnell Society and Donegal County Council. Now, just to explain the format here, this is a Hedge School. You're at school here, guys. You have to sit up, pay attention, sit up in your seat and participate. Don't just sit back and relax. You will be expected to participate in the discussion. So if you have any questions at any stage or any points to make, just get my attention. I have a radio mic here. And by the way, this is all being recorded, so keep it clean. Now, to get us started, I'll start with a simple question to you, Matthew. Explain the internal political situation in Donegal, say, pre-1590.
Okay, well,
in about 2 minutes.
Right, well, I'm going to start in 1566, when the current chieftain of the O'Donnells, Calvic O'Donnell, died, and he was replaced by his brother, Hugh McManus O'Donnell, father of Red Hugh. However, Calvic's son, Con, really wanted to be chieftain, but he was in prison at the time, so he couldn't stake a claim, and he saw Hugh McManus O'Donnell's taken of the chieftainship as he was usurped. That's what he thought. But Hugh McManus was able to become chieftain because partly through English support, because this was when Shane O'Neill was rebelling and they needed an O'Donnell to basically help suppress them. And ultimately, they were rewarded because Hugh McManus O'Donnell actually defeated Shane O'Neill. When Con got out, basically, that started a big divide because he spent the next 2 decades trying to regain the chieftainship. And actually, in 1581, he almost actually overthrew Hugh McManus, and Hugh McManus had to appeal to the government for help. And the following year, again, Hugh McManus was almost—he was described as utterly undone through Con O'Donnell's basically fighting against him. And Con O'Donnell was actually so strong that he was able to invade Connacht. He was able to leave Tyrconnell and invade Connacht to impose the traditional overlordship of the O'Donnells of Connacht. So that's how powerful he was. It was even said that he was using the O'Donnell title. He died the following year, and basically someone claiming to be his son, Hugh McCalvick O'Donnell, took over that that faction of the O'Donnells. And In 1587, he was so strong that Tyrone Hugh O'Donnell complained that basically Hugh McCalvick O'Donnell had driven Red Hugh's father out of Tyrconnell. So we're almost at 1590 now. Will we talk about Eineen
Dhu? I just want to clarify then. So who is which faction is being backed by the English crown?
Well, they kind of switch.
That changes then.
When it suits them, it'll switch.
Okay. But at this stage, going back to Shane O'Neill's time, the O'Donnells essentially are being used as counters in Ulster against the O'Neills.
Yeah, because Hugh McManus defeated them at the Battle of Fastermore.
Right. Now, just to repeat, I'm not an expert in this area, right? The names, sometimes I get lost in all the names. So I'm assuming some of the audience might be in the same boat. Maybe not. So which one is Red Hugh's father?
That's Hugh McManus O'Donnell is Red Hugh's father.
Okay, so
he was a brother of Calvic O'Donnell.
No, he was married to another woman originally.
Right? Yes.
And how many sons did they have?
I know the main one was Donal O'Donnell.
Okay, so they're there in the background as well. Yeah. So they're another possible claimant later on. Okay, now, so then the marriage to Eineen Dubh takes place. Eamon, I want to bring you in on this. So who was Eineen Dubh? What was her real name, first of all? Who
was she? She was a daughter of you know, the Lord of the Isles. She was they were one of the two leading power brokers in Scotland in the early modern period. And in some ways, because of the systemic weakness of the Stuart dynasty going back to the Bruce, you had these two powerful families. And ultimately, the lordship of the Isles is something of a state within a state.
How big was it? Just give us an idea in general terms.
It would be the Highlands and Islands.
All the way, so all the Hebrides, all the way right down.
Between them and the what were known as Clan Yearmada, the Campbells of Argyll, they are the two big powerful families. And obviously there are lots of sub-families, but for various reasons, you know, these women are coming in from Scotland. Obviously, you know, the Sea of Mile is not a barrier, it's a fluvial superhighway. This is the same culture, they speak the same language, they patronise the same literati. But what these Scottish women are bringing in to these lordships, whether it's the lordship of O'Neill or the O'Donnell lordship, they're bringing in mercenaries, they're bringing in but it's essentially heavy infantry as dowries.
Can I go to Tomás on this one? Tomás, just on what did these guys bring to the table militarily? I'm talking about these red shanks, as they were called. So, like, what assets was Eineen Dubh bringing to the table?
Well, I think the main thing, I think the most obvious one is the Battle of Deir Leahan in 1590.
Hold fire on that one for a minute, right? Because I just want to talk in general terms, like made these guys, effective on the battlefield compared to the local Irish warriors.
Well, the Irish warfare in the period is usually small scale, kind of inter-family disputes. So you're looking at maybe a couple of hundred men, whereas these Scottish mercenaries coming in are fighting in larger scale battles. So that's not to say that the Irish were unskilled in warfare, but what these guys were bringing in is massive experience and different weapons technology that the Irish aren't really using. So, for example, the Red Shanks are using bows and arrows, whereas the Irish are using darts and, it's all close in, close quarter combat.
It's a higher level of warfare, basically.
It's a more it's a higher skill and larger scale,
right?
Tactical and strategic warfare.
And are these guys professional or semi-professional compared to the Irish?
There's a lot of them professional. Yeah, the Irish do have professional soldiers, which are Galaglass. But by 1590 and 1600, they're making way for more troops that are more formalized military groups, which are using more and more, they're getting more and more into using firearms. Whereas a Galaglass is generally using the battle axe, and he dominates the battlefield by his physical size and the folklore that goes around the idea of the Galaglass warrior, the Laic in Irish. So you have Laics, which are warriors, and you have Saigir, which are soldiers, and there's a distinct change in this period in warfare in Ireland.
So this is like the equivalent of bringing heavy artillery or a tank onto the battlefield facing infantry. I mean, it's a higher level of warfare. That's what I'm getting at.
So. Well, I suppose if you have a mass group of archers, let's say you have 300 archers who can fire 12 arrows a minute, and they can hit the target at 300 meters. I mean, that's an advantage. So if you have a Galaglass that's got a 6-foot battle axe and he has to get within 6 foot of you to make his strike count, he can strike you once, strike you twice. But I mean, you could get, in the time he's hit you two or three times, you could have already had three or four arrows fired at four different targets.
Okay, so we've established then, Ian Dhu is bringing to the table a much higher level of military force, basically. Now, Matthew, what does she do at this? Like, so she now becomes a player. She's now the second wife.
Yeah.
And they begat Red Hugh. So that Red Hugh is Ian Dhu's eldest son, right? So how does she proceed then to promote him as the successor of the lordship?
Well, after he was kidnapped by the English, he was confined into Dublin for 5 years in 1587.
No, before you go to the kidnap, you see, what I'm trying to establish is why was he kidnapped? You see, the point is, they kidnapped him for a reason. I'm assuming that the English recognize Ian Dhu and her offspring as a problem. So why was it perceived as a problem?
Well, one of the main reasons is because he was promised to the daughter of Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone, when the Lord Deputy came after him. Like I said, one of the reasons he pointed out was he's matched in marriage to the greatest in Ulster. So that was one of the reasons.
So they're threatening, there's a threat of an O'Donnell O'Neill alliance, right? Billy, can I bring you in this, right? So what's the English government's response to this? They're obviously looking on, concerned at this, because this has blown apart their whole strategy, is it not?
Hmm. I mean, I could start in 1566 too, you know, which is the first ascent of English troops and the Foyle. So they've been planning this for a long, long time. As far back as 1566, Edward Randolph arrives here with a fleet, apparently Essex too, they've been planning this for a long time. And the English are fighting in two contexts here. They're worried about the Scots as well as the Irish. And they see, if you look at a map of Ireland in the 1580s, like Boazio's map, 1588, right, just after the Armada, you will see that near every church, every town, and Leinster, Connacht, and Munster are marking that map. Boazio, Ulster looks as if it's from the moon. He hasn't a clue what's going on in Ulster. So they're starting to move. They see this as a strategic threat to the rest of, they've already conquered much of the rest of Ireland. And I mean, they're sending them at this early stage, cartographers and merchants. And I mean, Robert, if you go to the Tower Museum, there's a lovely mannequin of Robert Bartlett, the cartographer. But he still has his head on. Well, he didn't had his head on when I arrived here because the O'Donnells took it off. It says because they would not have their country discovered. So they know what's going on. They know that this is about to happen. And I mean, what happens eventually is that they do get a massive, what happened to Randolph was he went down to Muff and got hit up a head with a spear, right? And that was the end of him. The English then go back into Derry, which they had always planned to make the fortress and citadel. This is where they're going to. They move back into Derry. According to the English, this was an accident. An early example of the dangers of smoking. They blew up the entire garrison. Somebody knocked a pipe on the powder, right? But according to the Irish, and it links with the Irish perception too of what's happening about their culture and everything else. The Irish say this happened providentially, that this was a wolf ran down from the surrounding mountains with a firebrand in its mouth, threw it under a magazine and blew all the English up. And the English soldiers run out screaming out of them, the great god Columba has killed us all. The Irish Saint Columba, right? But they never give up on that plan. And it's only during the 9 Years' War then, how do you conquer Ulster? How do you eventually conquer Ulster? How do you get into the place? The Mowry Pass, they're often blocked getting in the Mowry Pass. The Foyle, as they know, is the gateway into the centre of Ulster. So they send Sir Henry Dacre with 4,000 troops, as he says himself, on this desperate enterprise.
Yeah, but Billy, just going back to, you see, why did they, they kidnap Red Hugh, right? Yeah, they entice him on this boat, drink a glass of wine, whatever. It's happened to all of us, you know. He stayed too long, got kidnapped. Why didn't they just kill him?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think
Matthew'd be better than
you. Matthew, yeah, any views on that? Like, you know, well, given the trouble he caused them later, you know.
Well, like, you got to realize they don't have hindsight like us. They didn't know. But also, like,
hold him as a hostage.
Yeah, if you don't have a hostage,
yeah,
a dead hostage isn't much use. Because don't forget, he was a hostage for the O'Donnells and Hugh O'Neill. Because Hugh O'Neill's constantly complaining, writing to the English, trying to get him out and saying he takes it as a personal insult and an attack on him, which it was.
Now, the thing is, okay, meanwhile, back in Donegal, right, Inian Dhu presumably is not happy because her son is on the lock and key in Dublin Castle. And this would seem to knock the whole bottom out of her strategy, right? So what does she do? What does she do? I mean, maybe tomorrow you talk about this because it's the Dura Land thing comes in.
Yeah, well,
how does she manage? Like, on the face of it, her position is completely shot. Her candidate is on the lock and key.
Well,
the other factions are in the ascendant.
The thing with the Red Q's abduction is that the initial plan was to abduct Inian Dhu and his father and young Red Hugh, but they could never.
She didn't take a drink, presumably.
They could never get into a situation where they could get everybody together. And I think this is probably one of the reasons why children were fostered out to other families, because you never had the complete clan in the one spot where you could wipe them out. I mean, look at the Geraldines, for example. So they were like
the old Moors, yeah, well, at Mull of Mass.
You know, Mull of Mass and all of those things. So, I mean, she's under, like I may not be correct on my, this is my theory is that she's bringing in a kind of protogenitory thing, whereas, you know, the Gaelic Irish are still using the tanistry. So her view of Red Hugh taking over is basically, you know, her eldest son is going to take over the kingship. But I mean, she handed over 30 Spanish sailors to the English to get Red Hugh's freedom. That was one. Those 30 Spanish sailors were then killed by the English, and she was told to get on her bike and go away. And she tried a lot of things to get him free. Hugh O'Neill went to Dublin. He offered them £1,000 to release him. They wouldn't release him. And I mean, the English would have known that his father was basically on dying. They would have known that when he died, there was going to be absolute chaos within the O'Donnell kingship. So, I mean, it suited them for him to die. They I think, underestimated her, though.
Okay, so they assume then that there would be a kind of an equal internecine contest rather than a clear winner.
Yeah.
But it was a clear winner. Just talk to us about Dura Land then. What happened there?
Well, I mean, she was challenged by one of, I think it was Donal O'Donnell.
What year are we now?
1590. Yeah. So while Red Hugh's in Dublin Castle, her kind of control of the clan while the husband is dying is challenged by Donal O'Donnell. She then takes great exception to being challenged. You could probably look at her like a she-wolf type character, I suppose, in that regard. She brings in Scottish redshanks from Scotland. She then meets Donal's army in Deir an Iahan, which is in, I think it's near Teelin. And what I read of it was, or my understanding, there's very little information on it, is that they were basically met at a river, and the archers come forward and they basically pummel Donal's troops with arrows.
How many people are we talking about? Many troops on either side, roughly? Any idea?
Well, I mean, we're not too sure, but I mean, I think she brings in a diary of 80 to 90 Redshanks Crawfords from Scotland, but then there's information there that says she brought in an additional 1,000 Redshanks.
Yeah, 1,000, like, I mean, say a few, 100 or 200 archers presumably would make a big difference in the battlefield.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's simple maths. Like, I mean, if you can fire 12 arrows, 300 men can fire 12 arrows a minute, within 5 minutes, each man's going to be carrying probably 2 dozen arrows.
Okay, so this is an example of Inian Dhu using her the military superiority at her disposal effectively.
Yeah.
And what's the result? I mean, are the other guys killed or what happens?
So Donal O'Donnell is killed, and I think it's 200 to 300 of his men are killed. So it basically cuts the legs from under him. You know, the military arm is gone. The leader is gone. So now you have these kind of, these people are now going to have to look for another leader. Okay, so, right. But I mean, this is all playing into the English hands. This is what the English are loving this because it's causing so much chaos. Like, it's, right. I mean, that's what they do. They divide and they conquer.
Yeah, but that's what they think, right? Because meanwhile, yeah. Eamon, Red Hugh escapes, right? And not just, I mean, he at the second attempt, as, you know, Oscar Wilde would have said, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. The thing about, you know, I don't know whether it was Tomás or Matthew mentioned the prospect of his father's death and absolute chaos. And it's important to remember the last thing that the Tudor dynasty wanted was absolute chaos. The one thing that Henry VIII and his daughter had was in common was that they were notoriously parsimonious. They were extravagant, but they didn't want to spend money and certainly not spending it in Ireland. And, you know, from the surrender and regrant policy in the 1550s, you know, to try and, essentially impose primogeniture, the whole, you know, attempt to, you know, after the murder of Matthew Fardorahor, the bastard who Conbacock recognised as his eldest son, you know, O'Neill was taken, he was fostered in the Pale, and the whole idea was to turn him into the Queen's O'Neill. But obviously in taking him into the Pale, she ultimately created a monster, because this was somebody who understood how the English fought and understood the necessity. And obviously, if he was going to go to war with the English, which he did, it was absolutely imperative that he had his western flank protected by O'Donnell. So he did ultimately use matrimony. You know, he married his daughter to O'Donnell. He married a daughter to McMahon, to Donal Ballyhoe Cahan. So in essentially, he used matrimony and he created a formidable alliance. And as Billy rightly pointed out, the only way that they succeeded in bringing him down was to basically create what was a snaffle by landing at Culmore and moving up through the Foyle, split the alliance, and then obviously it was imperative to dislocate or to detach, you know, Sir Ciarán O'Doherty, Neil Gareth and Donal Balla from that. But it took a huge amphibious operation in Derry. It took the landing of 17,000 men in Dublin under Essex and an amphibious operation across the Loch Ness to actually bring O'Neill down.
Just hold that for a second, because I want to go back to Matthew here, right? So Eanan Dhu has eliminated her enemies in Donegal, right? Red Hugh escapes, arrives back in Donegal, minus two of his big toes as a frostbite. And surely then this presumably cements then this growing O'Donnell-O'Neill alliance. So the end result is exactly the opposite of what the English had desired, presumably. Right, so just talk to us then about Hugh O'Neill and this developing alliance, because there was two marriages involved, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Double.
Hugh O'Neill was married to Red Hugh's sister, and Red Hugh was married to a daughter of Hugh O'Neill. And just to show the importance that Geoffrey Fenton, the Secretary of Ireland, he noted how important this alliance was. He said O'Donnell's, because historically the O'Donnell's and O'Neill's were always fighting. So he said, the O'Donnell's always at defiance with the O'Neill's and a great bridle to curb them in their greatest height. It is now combined with the Earl and a strong elbow to him. So the Earl was Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone. So that kind of shows how important and how this like changed things as well. Because like during the war, the president of Connacht, Connors Clifford, said, if either or Tyrone O'Donnell be broken thoroughly, the war is ended. So basically, if their alliance was the center of the Gaelic Confederacy that developed to fight the English, and if you get one of them, it's done.
No, Eamon. You, in the discussion before this, you were talking about some logistical weaknesses of this alliance. What are you referring to there?
Well, I suppose if you look at the two, if you look at the two great lordships that are at the centre of a phenomenally successful political and military alliance, after all, you know, O'Neill ultimately bankrupted the English crown. Elizabeth died before she brought him to heel. And crucial to that was O'Neill's western flank and the fact that he had, through marriage, he had, you know, essentially welded or brought all of these people into a political alliance. And Billy can talk about this in greater length, but, you know, by detaching the Queen's O'Doherty, Sir Cahir, from that alliance, you took what was a hugely important, if you like, you know, locker to feed O'Donnell and to feed the Irish armies. You also, by O'Neill's half-brother, Tureilach an Dá Thaobh, or two-sided Tureilach, he was detached, as was Sir Ughi O'Hanlon. He was given a knighthood, as was Sir Cahir. And then, obviously, by detaching Neil Gareth, O'Donnell lost what was... And, you know, if you look at the O'Donnell, if you look at County Donegal now, you know, the richest, wealthiest were in the... were Twix, Foyle and Swilly here. This was the breadbasket of O'Donnell's lordship, and he lost that. And ultimately, you know, detaching O'Neill and O'Donnell was crucial.
Sorry, Tom.
You want to come in there, Billy, on that? Just on the.
I mean, it was just to agree with what has been said. But I mean, Dockery's orders are explicit when he arrives in Derry. And they're, I mean,
sorry, Billy, when did it come in first? Like, when did it first?
1600, he lands in 1600, yeah, yeah. Right? But his orders are explicit, and they are the main order that he's given is to detach people, bring them under the Queen's protection, and detach them from these rebel lords. That's his main order, and that's what he does. And he says himself, you know, and his account of this, he says that I couldn't have done this. I mean, we could never have won here without the Irish, the help of the Irish, and particularly means Neil Gareth and so on. Neil Gareth emerges, even with Dockery, as the villain of the piece here, right? Dockery says, when at one time he had the heart of a lion and the venom of an asp, right? He says, so this is the way he describes him, right? And he falls out with everybody, and he ends up, you know, dying in the tower. But I mean, the thing not to lose sight of here, in many ways, is the policy that destroys O'Donnell and O'Neill, and Dockery calls it himself. It's an England, and they've done it before in south of the country. Frightfulness, and frightfulness just means terror. It always reminds me of the Japanese in China with the three alls: loot all, burn all, and kill all. You know, and it's important to remember that this was the state. The Irish are astounded at the brutality of the English. I mean, we talked there about small battles, you know, at Derry Haven and all. They've never come across inhumanity in this scale. You know, Fiennes Morrison describes coming with Chichester secretary, coming across a smell of meat. The policy is to induce famine, and just kill everything and induce a famine, or the famine will kill them. Then, Eamon, as Eamon says, Thomas, keep the O'Doherty's land. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he says he came across a savour of meat broiling, and he sent two soldiers to find out Chichester. And he says he came across three children, not one of them above 10 years, all roasting and broiling the upper parts of their mower. They've already eaten all their legs, and they'd ate the whole lot upwards to their runners, which they were now roasting over a fire. That's what you're talking about. That's the kind of war this was. You know, and it's important not to lose sight of that.
Thomas, can I bring you in on this, on the military side, right? In terms of the military tactics that Billy has described there of the English. I mean, was that par for the course for what was happening in Europe, say, at that time? Those type of tactics. You know, they're talking about this kind of total war.
Well, I mean, total war is what Henry VIII really starts to introduce the total war to Ireland. I mean, you've got a caste system in Ireland. So, I mean, if you're a Cairn or you're a Galaglass or you're a higher up, I mean, it's not good policy to kill the people that farm your land that generate your your revenue. So, I mean, when they're having bat wars between clans, it's certain castes or classes of men. It's Cairns, Ketchikairn or Cairn T, or as Galaglasses or a single combat. So when Henry VIII doesn't get his way and starts to get a bit uppity about the whole thing, and the Irish aren't just quite playing the game with him, I mean, he lets these guys in. So what he's doing is he's feeding in a small garrison of 100 or 200 men to, let's say, for example, Donegal town. These guys don't want to be there. Why would you? Like, if you're living in England and then you're sent to, like, Donegal, right? And then you're coming across these people that are looking at you sideways, and they're speaking a different language, and they dress differently, and their cultures are different, and they see these, they know that these people are full of superstitions and old stories, right? I mean, they're not going to look at them as equals. So when they get into, there's kind of a policy there where these troops come in and they cause trouble, and then what happens is that, let's say they get into, let's say they abuse some man's wife, he retaliates against the English soldiers. That's the English soldiers' excuse now to bring in reinforcements to basically put this, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, we were attacked and this man was killed. And then they have an excuse to come in with additional troops to basically say, oh, we're putting down this rebellion. Because I think Jim O'Neill talks about this in the 9 Years' War, where English soldiers are brought in and they're almost like a private enterprise. And then when this private enterprise is challenged, then they go to the Queen and say, oh, you know, we came in here to do this and these people have attacked us. We need the government's help to come in and help. Yeah, sorry, Billy.
Tommy, just on that point, the other thing that Sir Henry left us was, apart from his own account, as he served under Richard Bingham in Mayo, right? And Bingham is a notorious as a monster, right? And Dockrell left us his relation. Dockrell is a great fan of Bingham, right? Bingham was actually removed by the Queen because of the extremes of terror that he went in Mayo. And John McGurk, our colleague, our late colleague, John wrote the book. And John said to me during the book, he says, but I mean, Dockrell is accused by some people of leniency. And I said, well, this would have come as a great surprise to the Irish now that Dockrell has been a bit lenient. And the people who accused Dockrell have been lenient to his own troops. Who, because there's unfighting among the English too, Dockrell's from Yorkshire. These troops are all from Devon and, as Thomas says, Welsh. Half of them start deserting to the Irish, right? They're accusing Dockrell of leniency because they think it'll go down well with the Queen that he's not killing enough of the Irish. And I mean, they're writing letters from the camp. They very aptly named Sir Humphrey Covert as writing letters to Cecil, saying this guy's no good. He's written a tourist account here of what's going on, and you know.
Yeah, and I think you could add to that, it's 30, 40 years later, but when Hugh O'Neill, second Earl of Tyrone's nephew, Owen Rue O'Neill, lands in 1642. He's a professional soldier. He had a checkered career in Spanish Flanders. He's utterly appalled at the manner in which war has been waged in the 1640s and 50s, and he likens it to campaigns against the Grand Turk, because when, you know, there were, you know, Christian powers, kings, did adhere to the laws of war. You know, there are obviously exceptions, and the exceptions like Magdeburg and the 30 Years' War, or, you know, the activities of Gustavus Adolphus. But in the main, people adhered to Hugo Grotius's laws of war, except when it was European powers, whether it was the Tsar of Russia or whether it was the Holy Roman Emperor, you know, fighting against the Sublime Porte, they went in, they killed everything. And in many ways, war was conducted here in a similar fashion.
So it's an othering of your opponent, as not quite human.
Absolutely. In a way.
Billy, you want to say more on that?
As Eamon said, I mean, 30 years later, Owen Rowe said, if there is a hell on earth, Ulster is a hell on earth. I mean, that's as Eamon said, a professional soldier from the wars in Europe. That's what he says. And you know, so, and go ahead, Tommy.
No, just I want to just move on there a bit into the you know, around about 1600, just to reset the thing here. So you have this kind of total war taking place, spreads throughout the whole country, basically. You have this landing behind the lines by Dowcra, if I got this correct. And that bleeds the O'Donnell lordship from within, from behind, basically. Am I right there, right now? So my next question is, like, was it all over? Maybe you could win this one, Matthew. Like, Kinsale is seen as a great defeat, right? But was it all over before Kinsale, really, in reality?
I think it was, especially for O'Donnell, because he was pretty much kicked out, which you're calling by then. Like, and in 1607, when Rory O'Donnell and Hugh O'Neill, they're in Spain, they're making, they're writing letters to the king, and this is how they describe their situation. They were almost at the point of utter destruction, for we had lost most of our brothers, kinsmen, principal people, and vassals. We had exhausted all our resources. And Geoffrey Fenton, when O'Donnell was going down to Kinsale, he basically said, O'Donnell was driven out of his country and hath no way to restore it to him but to seek the aid of a foreign prince. So basically, Kinsale was his last chance. By then, he actually had evacuated most of his people, including his mother, to Sligo because he had no foothold pretty much left in Donegal.
Okay, so his home place is hollowed out. In other words, he's been pushed out of the center of his main center of power, if you like, in Donegal. Yeah, because see, generally it's held that the Spanish landing Kinsale was a big mistake. You know, the land at the wrong end of the country. From what you guys are saying, it was exactly the right place to land because of Dowcra and what he was doing up there. But what would you say to that?
No, there's something that has always puzzled me here, right? And I don't know enough about it to come to a conclusion, or I don't think of the sources to do it. But it seems to me very canny in some ways. And very, if Dowcra himself was a bit suspicious about O'Doherty, because O'Doherty's lands are left pristine. That's a granary to feed an army. You know, and then Derry itself, of course, salmon. But that's a granary to feed an army. And Eamon would know, or Matthew and Eamon and Thomas would know, Raymond O'Gallagher, the Archbishop, has been meeting regularly with Spanish land and Kelly Beggs. Now, maybe the Satnoff is off later and it starts with a cable gone there, like, right? But I don't know. But if you had that granary there, I think that was done, there was something going on there. This is to feed the Spanish army because everything else has been destroyed. The O'Cahan's lands, McSwain's, the O'Donnell's. The frightfulness has wiped out everything in these areas. An army can't live off that. And these armies live off the land. So maybe some members of our panel could comment that because I don't know, but I think there's something happening there.
My point is, though, that land for the Spanish land in Kinsale, it isn't such a bad move, given what you've described about what Dowcra was up to. You know, the fact that they had gotten in behind the lines, if you like, right? Mm. Now, just moving on. No, my next point is, Red Hugh's march then down to Kinsale is normally seen as this heroic thing, which it was. But in many respects, he had no choice, did he? I mean, he could only go forward. He couldn't go back.
I think he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't, because if he didn't support the Spanish, there'd be no point the Irish coming to the Spanish again. You see, I mean, with the Gila and all, I mean, there are accounts of Spanish, that there was a massive armada to come to Ireland. It was supposed to land in Galway. That was the preferred landing spot. There was a big inquiry after Kinsale by the Spanish government as to what went wrong. And what they discovered was that there were ships from Lisbon, and what they were doing, the sailors were doing, was drilling holes in the hull of the ship. So when we go out to sea, it would start to leak and they would have to turn back because the Spanish soldiers didn't want to come to Ireland.
Right.
That's just one of the things. I mean, there is a huge lot of new kind of information out there on this. But I mean,
did they know where they were going?
The Spanish knew Kinsale very, very well.
Okay,
they knew
Killy, trading
yeah.
links. Okay.
And they knew Killy Beggs very, very well. But there's a very good article by Oscar Morales on the Spanish attitude to the war in Ireland, which would be worth people have a read, just to give a kind of a sideways look at why there was a problem here. So, I mean, it's not that, I mean, they say they landed in Kinsale because of the weather, but I mean, if you've got ships that sailors drilling holes in their own hulls, the way that they can turn back, then they're, Billy's correct. There is something. There's a story there that nobody has got their grips, got to grips with yet. So, I mean, did the Spanish view, you know, had the Irish, the use of this Irish war against the heretic queen, had this run its course? Do you know? I mean, the Kinsale expedition by the Spanish is an absolute mess.
Just before we talk about the Kinsale, I want to talk about that in a little bit of detail. Just in terms of going back to this question of the English adopting total war, I mean, did the Gaelic Irish up their game to respond to it?
Well, I'm going to be very politically correct here. We didn't do anything wrong. No, I mean our own, like, I mean, we have.
No, I'm talking in terms of the military technology, the tactics, professional.
Oh, yeah, well, sort of thing. That was one of the things I was going to say. See, so the proportion of muskets to pikes in the English army is one third musket to two thirds pike, roughly. The proportion of Irish troops being musketized is 50-50. So the way that, for example,
more muskets.
It was a half and half split. The Hugh O'Neill had said to the English, look, you know, I'm getting threatened by such and such a person, and I know I need to get a small army together to protect my lands. And the English said, okay, yeah, you can train 600 men. So what they did was they assigned an English officer to oversee the training. But what O'Neill was doing was that he would, every time he was training 600 men, he would meet somebody,
right,
or some young lad in the field,
yeah,
they would show them how to fire a musket.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were continually different 600 men each time. And by the time the 9 years war comes, he's got quite a heavily musket, firearm group. So what, the way he did this, which is interesting, I see the display down there. There's a red jacket. It's called a cassock. It's basically like a maternity dress type thing. What he did with what O'Neill did was he dressed his men in these red coats. So when the English officer came to look at these troops, all he saw was a massive sea of red, 600 men dressed in red. So he's not going to really notice their faces. And this is how O'Neill was a very clever man in that regard. But the problem with having your army using muskets is you've got to get lead for them, you've got to get match for them, you've got to get muskets for them, and you've got to get powder for them.
Right.
I think there's another, you know, a hugely important thing as well. And obviously, Tomás is exactly right in the manner in which O'Neill prepared, laid the ground for war. But the other key factor here was that Ireland was a really unhealthy place for English soldiers to operate. And if you think that, you know, Essex landed in Dublin with 17,000 men, like, that's more than Britain deployed in Afghanistan or Iraq. Like, these are huge numbers. Within 9 months, most of them are dead, not only because of Irish skirmishing, but primarily because of the Irish flux, or a bloody flux, which was a virulent form of typhus. The same thing happened to Dockery's army in Derry. And that's why detaching these, you know, figures like O'Hanlon, O'Cahan, O'Doherty and Neil Gareth was so important, because they were losing huge numbers of men. And also the Queen was dying. You know, we know with the benefit of hindsight, when the Treaty of London was signed, pretty much everybody knew then that the Spanish Empire was bankrupt, but England was bankrupt as well. We know now that the peace of 1604, the Treaty of London, held, but we have the omniscient benefit of hindsight. Yeah. It wasn't so clear in 1605 or 1606 that it was going to hold.
Tell you, I just wanted, Tomás, can I go back to you just to give us a recap. What happened at Kinsale, just in very general terms, right?
Oh.
I wanted to follow up the question on Red Hugh's performance, but I think the audience need to know what happened first.
Kinsale, wow.
Well, I mean, how many troops the Spanish land, for example?
The Spanish land, about 4,000 men.
That's quite a lot, then.
That's not enough. They estimated that the Spanish would have needed to land over 6,000 war fighters to succeed in Ireland. So 4,000 odd land, but not all of them are war fighters. Right. So you've got your surgeons, you've got your logistics, you've got all. So, I mean, probably 2,500 of them would be war fighters. So what I mean by a war fighter is a man that goes in, fires a musket, thrusts a pike, or fights with a sword.
But tell us, going back to your thing about fellas drilling holes in hulls and stuff, I mean, how many thousand didn't make it? You know,
well,
supposed to be sent, but didn't get there.
Yeah, there was under 6,000 men.
Right.
Was the
6,000 sent, 4,000 arrived.
Yeah, right. 4,000.
What did they do once
they fortified themselves into the two castles in the town of Kinsale. And they're basically, when the English land, the Spanish ships leave and the English ships arrive, and they're basically
bottled up and
they're basically surrounded under siege.
How many troops then did the English have besieging Kinsale, roughly?
I can't remember. 12,000? Is it 12? 10? 12,000? 12. Something like that. Yeah.
I think by the end they say about 6,000 or left.
So they besieged the Spanish inside.
Yeah, they push the Spanish out of, they make the castles basically make the castles unviable for defence, because, I mean, you have a castle on one side of the harbour, you have a castle on the other side of the harbour, and then you have the town. So, I mean, they didn't have enough men to do all of that.
Yeah,
so they ensconced themselves into the town instead.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what the English seem to do, it's like the Battle of Alesia, is they surround the town facing in, and they surround the town facing out.
Presumably waiting for Neil and Donald to arrive.
So they would have had intelligence to say that they're these guys are on their way.
Now, no combat object until O'Neill and O'Donnell arrive. It's a phony war, presumably.
It's a siege, but the problem that the English have is the weather's killing them, the lack of food's killing them, the ague's killing them, the typhus is running through their camp.
And in general, a besieging force gets the worst of it.
Yeah, well, it's
besieged.
Rule of thumb is that if you've got a large body of men camped close together, I mean, you're looking at a canvas tent and you have six men sleeping side by side, head to toe, right? So after about 3 or 4 days, the fleas and the lice and everything gets through them. So you're starting to see typhus after about 3 days. That's generally the rule of thumb. So they're starting to die. Now, if O'Neill had, for example, held off, which is what he wanted to do for an additional week or 2 weeks, the English would have been finished. But there's a pressure on O'Donnell to get to Spain. And one of the theories or one of the assumptions is that O'Donnell put pressure on O'Neill to attack.
Yeah, but what about that? Let's get on to that then, because the kind of popular view is that, O'Neill is this wise owl, an older man. Yeah. Red Hughes is young hothead, you know, and jumps the gun and they're defeated, get scattered.
Yeah, there's one of the Maguires. He's killed the year before, and he was the brains behind O'Donnell's army, the tactical end of it. So when he's killed, it seems to be that Red Hugh would look like he's been let off the reins a little bit. So I mean, there's a lot of finger pointing at O'Donnell, but I mean, we don't know. We can't say for sure. I mean, one man says that the reason the Irish lost is because they had no stirrups on their horses. That's one theory. The other is that they lit their match for their muskets on the hill at night and they were seen. The other is that Red Hugh was a hothead and he jumped the gun. I mean, you know, depending on what theory you want to go with, is where you can go with it.
And so, how many troops did they have between them, O'Donnell and O'Neill?
Oh, he had about
5,000.
Yeah. And then you have
also smaller, much, much smaller than the English force.
But as they're coming down through the country, they're gathering troops.
Okay.
And O'Donnell and O'Neill's troops would have been well versed in the tertio tactics, but the troops that they were bringing in weren't. So one of the problems is when the English actually do their sally out and attack O'Donnell and O'Neill, a lot of the troops that they're attacking are green soldiers. So when they break and run, they run backwards into their own formations and it causes a problem, like Scarfallis.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is all theory. Like, it's like there's no real.
Okay, then next question. Like, meanwhile, what were the Spanish doing?
Well, the Spanish were supposed to come out and attack the English from behind, but they didn't do that.
And also, I don't know whether it's an apocrypha, but supposedly when O'Donnell arrived on the field after his lightning march in horrific weather, Don Juan de Cui was supposed to look out across the wall and at the Irish and said, surely Christ didn't die for these people. So I don't know.
I don't think we can theorize all we want, but unless you have a time machine to go back, we're never going to know really what happened. You know, was there a traitor in the O'Donnell or O'Neill camp that
there is the also English? A rumor that McMahon, I shouldn't say this as a Monaghan man, but McMahon sold the Irish plans for a bottle of whiskey. Whether that's
he's not from Cavan.
From what you're all saying, it seems to me that in a way Kinsale wasn't as crucial as it was later seen. In other words, that they were already on the back foot anyway, even before Kinsale. And then they had to fight the Battle of Kinsale. They had to go to the aid of the Spanish.
Well, I think the importance of landing in Galway was to get the backing of the Clan Rickards.
Mm.
That was one of them. But I mean, if we theorise that, let's say the Spanish, let's say a proper expedition of, let's say 7,000 men landed, let's say Killybegs. Yeah. You know, your big problem in landing in Killybegs is getting out of Killybegs into the hinterland. But would that land have been sufficient to create confidence in the other Irish to say, do you know what? Yeah, we're going to go back.
I think what's also crucial as well, and you know, we can go over how the war was fought. But I think O'Neill's great failure was his inability to get the old English, who basically monopolised not only political power, but the wealth of the island. And in a sense, it was their failure as well, because ultimately in the next 30 years, King James dismantled and they're subsequently destroyed in the War of the Three Kingdoms.
No, but my point, I want to wrap up and can say, I'm going to bring you in then, Matthew. No, my point is that what you've listed there are several what ifs, not just one or two. There's about 10 of them, right? So it puts Kinsale in a different light for me, anyway, I have to say, in this discussion. Matthew, I want to go to you next then. Okay, why did Red Hugh go into exile then?
Because I think what I was saying.
He yielded.
Immediately,
anyway.
Because basically, he had nowhere to go. He couldn't go home like he was. Like I was saying earlier, he was basically kicked out. But just in regards to him being described as a hothead, at the Battle of Moray Pass, he was said to have written a letter to O'Neill.
When was that?
1600, September, October. And there was like a report from a spy that O'Donnell had written a letter given out to O'Neill for engaging with the Lord Deputy Mountjoy. And O'Donnell said he should have let him pass and let like the weather basically get rid of most of his army, and then Mountjoy would plant a garrison. He would leave more men there, so he'd lose more men and then attack him on the way back. So that would kind of suggest he wasn't this hothead, because like the Spanish don't mention him arguing with O'Neill to fight. So there's no mention from the Spanish sources either, so that would suggest maybe he didn't urge O'Neill to fight.
Yeah, but anyway, so he goes into exile because he's no choice, you're saying. Billy, where's Enid Dhu at this stage? What happens to her?
Well, Enid Dhu is captured in and Sligo.
Yeah.
By Dogra in 1601. And I can't remember. She's sent to Dublin, anyway, I think, right? But he ends up being released eventually. And I mean, dies and some
again,
of
why wasn't she just taken out and, you know, killed? Sorry, I mean, they seem a little compunctious killing ordinary people like in the campaigns.
Yeah,
I mean, they still need what's
hostage,
left.
Hostage again?
But they still need to control Ulster. They're having the men to do it. They can't do it entirely by violence, right? As Dockra knew, I can't just use military might to defeat these people. I need them to help me.
Yeah.
And you have a sense you're sort of it's the same with O'Neill after 9 years' war. Sir Henry is fuming mad when he goes down to see the Lord Deputy. Sir Henry wants the fisheries of the Foyle. I mean, he wrote one time to Lord Cecil and said to him, could you send more barrels of salted fish for the men? And Cecil wrote across it, he's in the greatest fishery in Christendom, send him some nets. Right. And Sir Henry's then astounded when O'Neill is giving this back. You know, they're coming there. I mean, We can't really jump forward to a plantation, but in a sense we can. That's coming on board, that idea now, and especially after Sir Cahir's rebellion. You know, it's the English are rubbing their hands. It is great stuff. I mean, I think, I'm not sure. I mean, Chichester's actually on his way, and Davies, the
Attorney General.
The Attorney General is on his way to Ulster when they hear that O'Doherty rebels and happy days, right? We'll get the whole lot now. You know, we'll get all out of them. So I'm not sure. But why would they not kill her? Probably because they needed her. If they didn't need her, they'd have killed her.
Right. You know. And there's also the fact that, you know, they would have known that Queen Elizabeth is dying and who is ready to take the throne? James the Sixth. She's an important Scottish royalty, essentially. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about, you mentioned at the outset, the fighting prince of Donegal. I suppose the one thing that, you know, this idea of O'Neill as cool and calculating and as the strategist, and this obviously is, this idea is also replicated and, you know, obviously based on Seanfhéin Whelan's classic, you know, The Great O'Neill, and it's replicated in Brian Friel's masterpiece, Making History. But in many ways, if you look at O'Neill spent his formative years as a ward and actually campaigning in Munster with the Lord Deputy, you know. O'Donnell spent his formative years rotting in Dublin Castle. He joins the rebellion. He's closer in some ways to Fermanagh, and he's also closer in some ways. He sees what's going on in Fermanagh. They're attempting to garrison Fermanagh. There's a sheriff appointed. And, you know, often in this instance, you think of, you know, and they did in contemporary parlance, you know, like brutish Indians, the wild Irish live. And I often sometimes think if you carry that to its conclusion and you look at O'Neill as Sitting Bull, you know, Sitting Bull went to New York, and when he saw the numberless masses getting off the ships, he said, you know, I'm going to go back home and make peace with the white man, because he realised that they could beat every army that the Great White Father sends to the plains, but they're never, you know, they're going to keep coming. O'Neill is a bit like that, but O'Neill has advantages that Sitting Bull doesn't have. He has the prospect of getting help from the King of Spain and also from the Bishop of Rome. O'Donnell, in some ways, is like the crazy horse character. You know, he's an enigma, even though, and both of them, you know, lie well in chronicle, because O'Neill, when he left Rathmullen, he brought a poet with him and he brought a historian. And obviously O'Donnell had Louis O'Clery to write his heroic biography, and he had the Owen Rua Mac Award, you know, to sing his praises as well.
I can see the sequel of that movie now, Evie. Red Hugh O'Donnell and Crazy Horse, an irresistible title. I just want to wrap up on Red Hugh, Matthew. Was he poisoned? How did he die?
It's highly doubtful. This kind of idea came from this guy, James Blake, who offered to the president of Munster, George Carew, to poison him, and he went to Spain. But prior before his death, like, he vomited a tapeworm. So that was...
There's far too much detail in this panel, I have to say, right?
And there's a quote from the Earl of Shrewsbury writing to Carew about the death of O'Donnell. He says, "The death of O'Donnell is very welcome news to us here, and no less cause to you there. There goeth a report here that a kind of snake or serpent has been found within him. It may be he was troubled with the worms, as many children and men be there."
And tell me, before he died, was he making any headway diplomatically?
Initially, it did look like they might send another expedition, but by the time he died, it wasn't looking great, because, like, just before he died, he went to the court to appeal again, because it looked like we were going to send 14,000, but then that got diverted to going to the Americas. So at the end, he was just begging for maybe get a couple of thousand to go back.
And of course, we now know Spain was in decline at this stage. Yeah. Like, it was bankrupt, and, you know, but that's again with hindsight. Listen, guys, I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. So if anyone has any question or contribution, now is the time.
Thank you. That's very, very important and interesting, especially the last thing about the McMahons and their deal. I think there could be a subtitle for a book sometime, The Bottle of Kinsale.
And there's a bottle of Ben Borm.
It's just what I'm wondering, how was all this financed? We've just had a budget here where 15 ministers divide up the money and have different plans for the coming year and so on, like education, health, which wouldn't have been existent in that way then, I imagine. But how was the finance raised and how was it spent? And was there any international trade to bring in finance?
Well, they got a lot from Spain. Like, they got a lot of supplies and money for Spain, and actually they actually used it as like to boost morale, because when the English debased their coin, they would show people the Spanish coin and saying, yeah, the Spanish king's money is still good, whereas like you have this, like they used to call it, like, money made from copper and tin. So like the Spanish was one source of finance. I don't know if anyone else.
Well, the fishing, the Loch Ney fishing and the Foyle and all of that. I mean, the O'Donnells are kind of recognized as the fisher kings. So, I mean, they're a lot of trade coming in. So, you know, they would have had a lot of money from land and tenants and everything else. So, I mean, it would have been personal wealth.
Killybegs,
yeah. There
was presumably a lot of corruption involved as well. I mean, if you were an English captain, it was kind of privatized, wasn't it? I mean, you'd be given so much say 1,000 troops, but you'd only raise 500, but the other left the money in your pocket. You know, so that's why you have this contradiction on the one hand, that the English state bankrupts itself, but lots of individuals operating on behalf of the English state enrich themselves. You know what I mean? So the money is just circulating, you know.
I think it was after Sir Francis Drake attacked and burned Cadiz, you know, contemporary accounts gloated in his singeing the beard of the King of Spain. And as Professor Alan McInnes from the University of Aberdeen said about the 9 Years' War, that King James VI of Scotland was happy to turn a blind eye while, you know, some of his subjects lathered the tights of the Queen of England. And there's probably one of the finest surviving, you know, relics from this period is a beautiful three-legged medieval chalice, the Dunvegan chalice, which is on the Isle of Skye, Rory Moore MacLeod. And that was a McMahon chalice that was given to O'Neill as part of a dowry for one of his daughters. And he gave that to Rory Moore MacLeod, you know, in recompense for military support during the war. So there's a lot of support coming from Gaelic Scotland. And a friend of mine, Andrew MacKillop, wrote a book, More Fruitful Than the Soil, about, you know, the Scottish Highlands and recruitment. And when you think from the Middle Ages until the Battle of Waterloo, there's a huge military, you know, contribution, not only to the Scottish crown, to the English crown, to Britain, but also to the Spanish, to the French, and also to Ireland. Like, this is a highly militarized part of the world, and they're supporting O'Neill.
The English are obviously supplied by the Queen's Exchequer, but it's all privatized, too, as Emmett says. One of the things that Docker's accused of by his officers is that he's a plan for the money for 5,000 men, but 1,000 of them's dead, right? So it's only 4,000 men. So he's still getting the money. And that's a play. And I mean, the other thing I would just like to say, as Emmett said, that the Scots are playing, they're all playing a double game. James offered Elizabeth Scottish troops to defeat O'Neill. And, you know, and who one of our ministers says to be very good. He says, I don't know what kind of vision he had of Ireland, but that they could nip nimbly across the bogs after each other, right? But what is Burley saying, Elizabeth's minister? He says, that will never work. He says, because dogs will not eat the flesh of dogs. These are the same. The Scots and them are the same, you know?
Any other questions before we wrap up?
Thanks. Thank you very much to the panel overall and to Mr. Graham for sharing it. I think if we look back a bit before Kinsale in the 9 Years' War, the composition of Connacht had something to do with the erosion of O'Donnell power. Would you agree with that? And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that in the Spanish Armada, there were a good 12 serious galleons or vessels which were not actually Spanish. They came from Ragusa in the Adriatic, and thousands of men died in that. Now, those Ragusans would have been seasoned warriors who might well have fought against the Turks in the Balkans. So what you're saying about the savagery of those battles of Christendom versus the Ottoman power are actually extremely important. But, of course, many of them were lost along the coast. And they picked up some people from Portugal on the way. And some of the people that they picked up from Portugal were actually conversos. There were Jews who were forcibly conversed into Christianity. And I'm told by Stuart Rosenblatt and others that, in actual fact, some of these Jews survived thanks to being taken in by none other than Catholic priests. And you know, their DNA may be somewhere on the map of Ireland.
You know, that's an interesting point about the Ragusans, because in the 1680s and 1690s, in the 1690s during the war, a lot of, like, you know, European soldiers call Irish, you know, rapparees, they call them Tartars or Croats. And of course, you know, they would have, those, if you go to Vienna to the fantastic, you know, weapons displays that they have from the 17th century, you'll see the sort of weaponry that Ragusans, or, you know, they would have been like dragoon style soldiers. And of course, the other thing you mentioned there about their role in wars against the Turks, when they excavated the cannons that were found in Sligo, there were some of them had Arabic inscriptions on them. They would have been captured probably at Lefanto, you know, which was the great between Don Juan of Austria and the Sublime Port.
Just curious in terms of why just O'Neill and O'Donnell in terms of the rest of Ulster. I mean, I don't know when Donal Balloch O'Cahan, let's say, would have been imprisoned, when sort of all of that started. How come there wasn't any activity and we heard nothing about what they were doing while it went on?
Matthew, that'd be...
Well, I think when the O'Cahans actually saved O'Neill's life, one of the first battles at Clontibert, I think someone from the Pale, they charged up and knocked O'Neill off his horse, and it was about to basically kill him. And then one of the son of the O'Cahans, basically just stopped him just in time. So, and with regards to the war, it was all over Ulster. Like, you had the Maguires, the McMahons, the O'Reillys, the O'Neills of Clan Dubois. It was like all around Ulster. It's just like, as I was saying, the alliance between O'Donnell and O'Neill was the most important. And once, if you stop that, it was over. Now, time, like, you could have another whole talk about the rest of the clans of Ulster.
Now, I want to just go back to Eanin Dhu, right? Because she outlives her son, Red Hugh. Billy has already said that she was captured by Dagra, but then she was released, right? So, Matthew, like, what happens? She dies in 1611, right? But she's a mover and shaker right to the end, isn't she?
Well, she testifies against Niall Garve, and you could interpret that as revenge for what.
Is this the pot calling the kettle black? I mean, he was the creature of the crown originally, yeah. Right?
Well, the thing with Niall Garve, I think he was quite ignorant. Like, there's some Ulster lords that kind of realized like the jig was up, but he didn't. Like, he thought like, one of the reasons him and Dacre kept fighting was because, like, he wanted to act as a traditional Gaelic lord, and that kept causing conflict with Dacre. So I think he was quite ignorant of, this was the death of Gaelic Garden, because he took the O'Donnell title thinking he could just do it. But that caused the English wanted to obviously get rid of Gaelic titles, so that caused, like, a lot of arguments between him and Dacre. So he just seemed really ignorant. Like he didn't realize, like, things were changing. He couldn't be an O'Donnell lord.
Okay, so he thought he'd done what Hugh O'Neill had done. In other words, he used the backing of the English to catapult himself to the lordship.
Yeah.
And then he falls foul of his masters, essentially. So, no, my point here is that Eanin Dhu doesn't just implicate him, but she implicates him effectively. Like, yeah, he's taken to the tower and then he dies, right? Like, so she takes him out, you know.
Well, he was never actually convicted, so
yeah,
it was a tender.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I'm going to have to wrap it up there, right? I just want to make throw out one final question here, is that should we be commemorating Inan Dhu, not Red Hugh? Anyone, any views on that? Or maybe we just commemorate the two of them in tandem, right? Listen, I'm going to have to wrap this up here. I'd just like to thank our speakers there, Billy Kelly, Matthew McGinty, Tomasa Brogan, Eamon O'Queira. I'd just like to thank everyone here in Maggie's. Very, very great reception here. Great steak, by the way. I'd recommend it. I just want to mention our next Hedge School. The title is Taking Our Place Amongst the Nations of the Earth, Ireland and the League of Nations. And we're staying in the county for that one. That'll be at the Allingham Festival in my native Ballyshannon at 6 p.m. Saturday the 11th of November in the Abbey Centre. And it's not too far away, so hopefully I'll see some of you there. Thank you very much. Oh yeah, and a final word to Nigel, our man on sound, has done a great job here. Listen, thanks very much for your attention. Thank you.